Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Jake, one of the hosts on the channel. Today, we'll be talking with Ignacio Cafone, who is the Canada Research Chair of Artificial Intelligence Law and Data Governance at McGill University, about his new book, The Privacy Fallacy. Ignacio, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jake. Thank you for having me here. I'm very happy to talk about this with you.
I was wondering if we could start off the interview by you telling me a little bit about yourself and how you came to write this book.
Of course. So I've been writing about privacy for about 10 years now from different angles. And as I kept writing different smaller ideas that I would put in papers, I started noticing that I did have a view of the broader idea that was between those papers, and I thought I should write a book about it. So I noticed when I was working on different questions of standing, data ownership, consumer protection, that I thought the common element among many of the problems that exist in privacy law is that we tend to look into this consent provisions too much or in control mechanisms too much. And we know to a large extent from a lot of great writing about it that those are insufficient. But the consequences of the insufficiency of those consent and control mechanisms are not always obvious. So there are different efforts to overcome them, like information fiduciaries, like privacy by design. And I thought that liability basing privacy more on tort law could be another broader approach to solving those inefficiencies, to giving the answer to the so what question that often comes up when we say that traditional mechanisms of consent and control don't address harms, particularly in light of AI, that well anymore.
Could you provide our listeners with what privacy means to you and to this book?
Of course, and that's such a good question. Privacy is, as you say, quite a fuzzy concept sometimes, and people may have different intuitions about us. And I think many of our disagreements about privacy are about using different definitions of privacy. I tend to think about privacy as a socially appropriate information flow. So what is a collection, use, or disclosure of information that is socially appropriate and that is appropriate under our social values, and which are ones that are not? And I think that when people disagree with many of the things that I or other privacy scholars argue for, sometimes it comes from this different understanding about what privacy means. So for example, one thing that you often hear is people saying, well, people shouldn't care about their privacy if they have nothing to hide. That's almost a cliche that you hear in policy circles and on the news sometimes. And when people say that, they almost never mean people shouldn't care about information being communicated appropriately and information being communicated in accordance with social values unless people have something to hide. They usually mean that secrecy shouldn't be that important unless people have something to hide. But I don't think privacy is about secrecy. I think lots of private things are not secrets. For example, when we share something with a group of people, we retain some privacy over it, even though that information is not necessarily secret. And I also think that there are lots of secrets that are not about privacy. Lots of trade secrets, for example, held by companies are secret, but are not necessarily about privacy. And once we have this different view of privacy that's a bit more nuanced and that's more linked with the things that we care about as a society, that dissipates lots of the confusion that we could have about privacy in the law, about why we're protecting it and about how we should protect it.
And speaking of protection, you open the book talking a little bit about data harms, and you go throughout the book giving good examples. I was wondering if you could define for listeners, what exactly is a data harm, how that relates to privacy, and why might it be a bad thing?
Lots of harms can happen because of data practices. We could get our identity stolen. We could get our credit card copied. We could be subjected to physical harassment because someone revealed our location. We could be discriminated against. We could pay a higher price for a certain premium. All of those harms are very real, and they're harms that the law addresses in a number of areas that can be enabled by data practices. It is important to recognize them, but I think that as we do recognize them, it is also important to recognize that data practices can harm people's privacy. And those are not necessarily the same thing. It is a bit missing the forest for the trees to say that privacy is only important because of those consequences that can happen from data practices. It is a bit like the digital version of what I was saying before, that you should only care about your privacy if you have something to hide. In this version is, you should only care about your privacy if you have a physical or economic or tangible harm that might happen to you if you don't protect your privacy. But people care about the privacy in and of itself, besides those tangential consequences. So imagine, for example, that a transgender person gets outed at work. And imagine that they work for an employer who's a bigot and fires them for being transgender. One should analyze that situation as the transgender person suffered a privacy harm from their, let's say, colleague that outed them at work as being trans, and then suffered a discrimination harm and financial harm of being fired unfairly. You'd be wrong to say that if the person gets rehired, no harm was done, because the reality is that they have to live having been outed at their employment, and the person that outed them robbed them of the ability to decide who they want to share their identity with and who they want to share their information about themselves with. So that shows that harm to privacy and the consequences of those harms to privacy, like being discriminated against and losing money, are important, but they're distinct. And recognizing that they're distinct is relevant for compensating them sufficiently and for preventing them adequately.
Taking that answer and actually weirdly moving a little bit backwards, what's the traditional approach to privacy that maybe doesn't have such a sufficiently nuanced view around privacy and data harms?
The traditional approach to privacy is to view it as some sort of consumer protection. And that is the way that North American privacy law, and to a large extent, European data protection law, were designed in the early 90s. The idea was that you have one person interacting with one company, and that person will give data to that company in exchange of products or services, and the company may directly collect information from the person to provide those products and services. And in that context, what we want to do is to provide transparency, is to give people meaningful choices, is to make sure that people are consenting to those data exchanges. But the reality is that data exchanges don't behave like consumer protection exchanges. They didn't back in the 90s that much, and they certainly do not now with data processing by AI. When we approach a cash register to buy something, that interaction starts and ends at that cash register. And they happen only every now and then, and we know when they happen. But data interactions happen second by second without our knowledge, and their consequences never leave us. Because differently than money that we can give to a company and then forget about it, the data that is collected from us, or that we give, or that is inferred about us, is relevant to our well-being forever. So that's a significant difference between that consumer interaction and data interactions. And to make it worse, most of the relevant information today, both in terms of profit and in terms of harms, is not data that is directly collected from people or directly provided from people, but it's rather data that is inferred about people based on different little pieces of data, sometimes thousands, sometimes even millions of them, that were collected at different moments in time. To make it worse, oftentimes those inferences are not necessarily about an individual, but about a group, about a trend, about a certain behavior, about groups of people with certain demographics. So in that context, it does very little to focus on those traditional mechanisms of tell people exactly how you're collecting their data. Make sure that people explicitly consent to that disclosed data. Because that transparency and that explicit consent, even if they were meaningful for the specific collection mechanisms and for the specific types of disclosed data, do not cover the all meaningful and all consequential inferences that happen in the back end. We could meaningfully consent to every like we give in a social network. We can meaningfully consent to every Spotify listen, but we can never consent to the host of inferences that are made based on those. And we certainly shouldn't be able to consent on behalf of others when those inferences also inform about groups of people that didn't necessarily give that information.
I was wondering if you could extend that discussion a little bit by talking about privacy policies and notice and choice and consent and how those three things combine together.
Part of the traditional system is relying on privacy policies. Privacy policies are this contract-like mechanism where we ask companies to tell, we can say consumers under that model, consumer-like people, data subjects in the EU, exactly what is happening with their data, what mechanisms companies use to collect it, sometimes how they disclose it, although that is often reduced to blanket statements like we shared with third parties. And usually the accusation that we see regarding privacy policies, which is true and it is fair, is that they are too long and that it's impossible to read them. Alicia McDonald and Rory Craner, more than a decade ago, I think, did a fantastic study that showed that if everyone read every privacy policy that they need to agree to engage in the digital economy, the average person would spend something like 280 hours per year to read all those privacy policies, which is obviously impossible. But the most important problem with privacy policies is not so much that we don't have time to read them and no one reads them. The main problem is that even if we did read them, and even if we could understand them, they wouldn't be so helpful. Privacy policies are written not only in technical jargon that we could mandate simplification for, but they don't tell us about what happens in the back end. They tell us about how our data is collected, they tell us about how our data is shared, and that could be helpful for us to make certain micro decisions about not sharing a particular type of sensitive data. But in a world where sensitive data like ethnicity, sexuality, political orientation are inferred from meaningless data like Spotify listens and coffee orders, it is not that helpful to give people that information about what happens with their disclosed pieces of information. So under the notice and choice system, we focus on improving that notice and improving that choice. We focus on making sure that companies are very clear about what they're doing, sanctioning them for unfair and deceptive practices if they're not clear about what they're doing, and making sure that people have choices. But that breaks down when we move away from the consumer model for privacy. It breaks down because we see that what is important is not anything that people have choices over, but rather the things that people cannot know about, and the things that even sometimes companies don't know about the moment that they're collecting the information, which is the risk produced by the inferences. And to see this, imagine that we took notice and choice very seriously. Imagine that we could actually perfect the system of notice and we could actually give people choices. Imagine that we break each social network in 20, 25 mini versions of it. And we have very strict rules about exactly the way that companies should inform people about what they're doing in clear, digestible, and understandable ways. That possibly wouldn't change the business model. And if you have 25 mini Googles, 25 mini Facebooks, 25 mini Instagrams with the same business model that they have now, telling people exactly how they collect data, but the harms and inferences being invisible to people, then we wouldn't solve the problem of privacy in the information economy. And because even in that perfect system that we cannot have of notice and choice, harming the information economy wouldn't be solved. We should try to do something else instead.
I think that leads us really nicely. Ignacio, what is the privacy fallacy?
I think the privacy fallacy is the contradiction of thinking that privacy is a social value that we want to protect, but then not thinking that privacy can be harmed in and of itself. We see that often when politicians say that they care about our privacy and they want to protect it. And I think most of the times they do mean it, but then the way that they have to protect us from privacy harms is preventing the negative, tangible consequences of privacy, is preventing credit card fraud, is preventing identity theft, is enhancing cybersecurity. All of those things are desirable and they're important, but a world where there was no privacy and we were immunized from all those external consequences from privacy invasions wouldn't be a world that most of us would want to live in. And that shows that there is a social value of privacy besides those. The privacy fallacy is also something that we fall for when we say what we were discussing earlier, that if someone has nothing to hide, then they shouldn't care about their privacy. Because the implicit view there is that the only reason for which privacy can be desirable is to hide something from others. We would commit the privacy fallacy if we think that the trans person that we're talking about that was hypothetically outed at work had all their problems solved if they had been rehired and remained outed. It is a fallacy because it's contradictory to say at the same time that privacy is important and that we cannot harm that thing that is very important. And I think acknowledging the privacy fallacy is important for seeing what kind of compensation is appropriate when we're trying to move away from this notice and choice system.
Speaking of which, why don't data protection rights and rules address the core problems of traditional contract model of privacy?
Most data protection rights And many rules in data protection law are incredibly helpful, and they can solve problems in a number of situations. The main issue that they have is that they rely on individual control, and control mechanisms extend the basic problems of consent that are in the notice and choice model. The problem with the notice and choice model is not the notice and it's not the choice, is that individual consent is not effective for preventing harm in the world where inferences are produced about individuals and about groups, and most of the harms happen because of those inferences, often involving AI, and not so much because of disclosed piece of information. So think, for example, of the right to be forgotten. The right to be forgotten can be helpful for a large number of people. It can be helpful for people that have pictures about them somewhere that they want to delete. It can be helpful for people that have defamatory comments somewhere that they think should be erased, or they at least think should be delinked from search engines. For those specific situations, it can be helpful, but it doesn't help the large dispersed harms that are produced by group inferences. And because it doesn't address those, which are the main thing that we should be concerned with today, it is a helpful addition to consent provisions, but certainly not something that is sufficient to address the reality that we're trying to address.
So you propose a paradigm shift from this traditional contract model privacy to building privacy law and liability. What exactly does that mean?
Privacy law and liability means building a system of accountability for the consequences of privacy practices. So right now, there are two sources of obligation for companies for which they can be liable. Either companies are liable because they did something that they said in their privacy policies that they wouldn't do, where the source of the obligation there is similar to contracts because it's similar to a breach to say that they won't do something and then doing it anyway. Or companies can be liable if they breach a specific provision from data protection law that they should be following. They may not have a data protection officer. They may have not submitted a privacy impact assessment. They may not have collected individual consent in the way that it is appropriate to collect individual consent. All of those things are good, but they have the same limitation. Because in the same way that individuals cannot predict the negative consequence of data practices to make meaningful choices about what data collection to agree to and what data collection not to agree to, regulators and legislators, even when fully informed, even when very capable, cannot make ex ante a checklist of very specific data practices that need to be done to immunize people from harm in the information economy. Because by its very nature, that harm depends on context, because that harm depends on the different uses of the information. It is very difficult to come up with specific procedural checklists that will say, okay, that guarantees that that data practice is safe and nothing will happen from it. So by having liability depend either on that contractual breach that is not following a privacy policy, or on that breach of a rule that a regulator or a legislator anticipated created a higher risk, we're leaving lots of things out. And we see this every day in the news. And we see this in every data scandal. We see companies that were able to comply with what they say in their privacy policies and were able to comply with what data protection law mandated and created enormous harm anyway. And many of the difficult cases that we see it precisely because regulators and enforcers notice this limitation. And they try to slowly change the meaning of these rules in data protection law to try to make them more expansive to cover for these things. One example is the large fine to Grindr that the Norwegian Data Protection Authority issued a bit over a year ago. Grindr is a gay dating app where people put a number of information about themselves, including their sexuality, including for many of them their HIV status. Grindr was found by the Norwegian Data Protection Authority to be sharing that information with third parties for a number of years. And when Data Protection Authority confronted the app about this, the company responded that they had a provision in their privacy policy that said that they could share data with third parties. And based on that provision in their privacy policy, they shared the sexuality and, for many of them, the HIV status of their user base. Grindr ended up being sanctioned by the authority by saying that because the information was sensitive, that very broad consent provision was insufficient. So it had shared data without consent. But if we stop to think about it, the real problem there was not the consent of their users. The real problem there was that the app exploited people who trusted it, exposing them to harms by sharing their sexuality and HIV status with undisclosed recipients while profiting from their data. Even if the consent of each user had been valid, clear, and very explicit. Even if Grindr had said, we are going to share your data with third parties, and some users agreed to it anyway, most of us would have considered that harmful. And this is something that we can catch with consent provisions, just because the collected information itself is the risky information. But oftentimes, this happens with information that was inoffensive when collected, but then is sensitive and harmful when inferred, and there no consent provision can save you. Cases like Grindr show that data protection provisions can be adjusted in some situations to extend into the specific data practices that are harmful that the legislators could anticipate in advance, but we cannot cover all of them. So if we want the information economy to be a place that is safe for people, where we can engage socially and economically in meaningful ways, and at the same time be protected from these harms, we need a system where companies are accountable, not for the promises they make in their privacy policies, nor for the checklist that they complete for regulators, but for the consequence of their data practices. And this may sound radical, but this is what the law does for an enormous number of areas where there are legitimate ways to make money that cause unintended harms for others.
So what would building privacy law and liability look like?
The most important aspect of building privacy and liability is tying it to its consequences. Building liability systems for breaching privacy policies, or building liability systems for breach of the GDPR, where private actors can sue for them, is desirable and can be helpful, but only increases the enforcement of those tying companies to their promises and tying companies to the provisions that regulators could anticipate would be desirable to reduce risk. It doesn't actually make them accountable for the consequences. Building privacy and liability means having a provision in data protection statutes that is somewhat similar to tort law, where when someone violated someone else's privacy, they are liable independently of the procedural provisions that they followed while doing so. This is similar to how the law deals with a number of other areas where we know that certain specific provisions will reduce risk and we want to mandate them, but we also know that we cannot anticipate all of the things that will reduce risk. Think, for example, of driving. When I'm driving somewhere, I need to have my lights working. I need to have my mirrors working. I need to drive under or at the speed limit. All of those things are regulatory aspects that the law tells me I must do because we believe that it will reduce the risk of getting in an accident. But even if I do all those and then I get into an accident, a judge can say that I wasn't driving carefully if I did something that meant that I wasn't driving carefully. And then I'll be liable for the consequence of that accident anyway. I do not get exempt from responsibility just by following those procedural provisions or by doing whatever I promised earlier that I will do while driving. And data harms are a bit of the same in that we do know that there are some things that will reduce risk. So it is desirable to mandate them, and it's desirable to have public enforcement making sure that companies follow them. But we shouldn't believe that that should be the end of the story. If a company has a data practice that exposed people to harm while they profited from doing so, like Grindr did when it sold its user base, including HIV status, to third parties, we shouldn't think that getting meaningless consent or following a certain specific provision, like they had a data protection officer and they followed a PIA, should be sufficient to exempt them from responsibility.
Well, Ignacio Cafone, thank you so much for coming on our show today, but that's about all the time we have. If our listeners want to find more about you and your work and this book, where can they go?
Thank you very much for having me. If listeners want to find more about this book, there's a website made for it called privacyfallacy.com, where there's information from the publisher and chapter by chapter summaries. If people are at a university, the ebook is available for free at most of them through Cambridge Core, so they can check if they have access to it from their library and they can read the chapter summaries and the book abstract. The Cambridge University page website also has some information about it, including chapter abstracts and a short description of it.
Wonderful. Well, thanks again for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.